This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Bombastic, audacious, revolutionary, rash, outraged, organised. Assertive activist days.
Broad.
On Joy 94.9.
This podcast is presented to you by Broad on Joy 94.9 at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival. Broad presents Feminism Through Narrative Nonfiction.
Or essentially writing women back into history. I want to start out by acknowledging that we've gathered here today on the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, and to pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and to elders from other communities who may be here today. Historians Claire Wright and Liz Connor speak about how they approach history as feminists in this session today. What are some of the challenges and the joys of questioning popular understandings of Australian history? I want to introduce you to our chair, Circle Chanelwitz, an Australian broadcaster with Turkish heritage. She's a graduate of the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts, who has worked behind the microphone, in front of the camera, and behind the scenes of radio and television programs across Australia. Most recently, she's been presenting the Sunday Sesh on ABC local radio broadcast nationally and acting as senior producer of Radio National's Sunday Extra program. I would like to acknowledge that this session is sponsored by UWA Publishing, which is a proud supporter of the Feminist Writers Festival and an advocate for equality across our society. Thank you so much. Can you just join me briefly in thanking you?
Christy mentioned our panellists today, Dr. Claire Wright and Dr. Liz Connor. Let me just introduce you both. Dr. Liz Connor is Chief Investigator of Graphic Encounters at the Department of Archaeology and History at La Trobe University. She's also a columnist and editor of the Aboriginal History Journal. And in this discussion, I'm going to be referring a lot to her book, Skin Deep, Settler Impressions of Aboriginal Women. And Claire Wright is a historian, author, and broadcaster. She's got a lot of books to her name, but in this discussion I'm going to be referring to her book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka. Now, I do want to start off with a quote. It's a quote from Geoffrey Blainey from The Tyranny of Distance, 1966. The quote is, "Every history of every country is a mirror of the author's own interests, and therefore selective rather than comprehensive." Now, let's elaborate on that from a feminist perspective. Both of these ladies have written about early settler times in Australia. Claire, if I can start with you. Now, when we look at our past, history is often documented from the perspective of men and male achievements. But in your book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, you look beyond the myth of the Australian goldfields as being an exclusively male domain. And most of us would know that the Eureka story is pretty legendary. But we don't hear about the Australian women. You wanted to tell the story about the women and their political legacy. How do you approach history as a feminist?
Well, I should say that quote, you guys, to give you some context about that Geoffrey Blainey quote, that's actually one of a couple of quotes that I used to start my book. And it's a bit cheeky because Geoffrey Blainey is obviously a very famous Australian historian. He's known as being a very conservative Australian historian. And he's written several nationalist studies. And And he's often taken to be kind of the last word. And he's certainly written about Eureka in one of his most famous books, is The Rush That Never Ended, about mining in Australia. And he writes about Eureka in that. So to pull a quote out of Blaney that says, all historians write selectively, was, you know, my little thumbs up to the historical world, mainstream historical world as we know it. So that's just a bit of context for that. I suppose the thing about doing the Eureka Project is that, in terms of going about it as a feminist scholar, is that I think that it was really important to me, and I think that this is the crux of feminist scholarship, is that it's really important what questions you ask. You can't anticipate the answer, because then you're writing very, you're writing politically loaded, indeed politically directed history. And I don't think that's good history. I think that might be polemic. It might be the good basis of a manifesto, but it doesn't make for good history. And what I mean by that is that what I did with that book was I set about with the question, which was, were there women at the Eureka Stockade? Because this is a story that had always been told as if only men were there. It's how I learnt about it in school, how all of us learnt about it in primary school, secondary school, how our kids still learn about it. I've got kids in primary school and in high school, and they've all learnt about the Eureka Stockade, and they still learn about it, well, until my book came out, as if there were there was the military versus the miners, and they had a battle on the frontier, and more miners than military got killed, and out of this we had the birth of democracy. But the picture of that, the way that that's taught, is that the only participants in this battle that made us who we are today were men, and that's implicit in the story. And I'd never thought to question that as a school child. I'd never thought to question it in my early years as an historian. But certain other work that I'd done, my PhD that led to my first book was about female publicans, about women in the hotel industry, another area that had been exclusively gendered male, and the assumptions that were made about that space. But then when I went back into the primary archive for my PhD and went and looked at the licensing records and looked at the, you know, the hard primary evidence, what actually came out of that was that more women than men ran pubs. And in the 19th and early 20th century, hotel keeping was decidedly a women's business. Mm-hmm. Women dominated that as a commercial industry. So armed with that kind of understanding, I went to the Eureka question, another space that has been, you know, a key Australian cultural and historical part of our narrative, and asked the question, were women there? I had an inkling that they might be, but you know, that was the primary question. It's a very simple one, but a very disruptive one in its own way. And so it was by setting that question that, you know, were women there? If yes, how many? If no, why not? But if there were women, how many? Were there just a few? Well, that must have been an interesting life, but maybe there were more than that. And if there were quite a lot of women who were there, well, what were they doing? What were they doing there? What did their lives look like? And did they participate in these political events that have constituted what it means to be an Australian in some kind of way? So it's that series of cascading questions that I think opens the space then to go into the archive, into the records, and find out what's there, to sweep away the mythology, the 150 years of people like Geoffrey Blainey and Geoffrey Searle and every major Australian male historian, and say, sweep away all of that and just build the story from the ground up. And lo and behold, it became a story about the women at Eureka because the women were there, because a third of the Ballarat population were women and children, because they were occupying every single space, economic, social, cultural and political, because women died at the Eureka Stockade. And because of all of those things, everybody who was commentating at the time, writing letters, writing diaries, writing for newspapers, giving evidence to royal commissions, all of those people, most of them men, talked about the women because they were there, they were part of their daily lives. So I suppose that's a long way of saying, as a feminist historian, I think it's important to get to question the dominant narratives, but not go in necessarily thinking that you already know the answers, because otherwise you're just picking up bits of evidence that establish a case that you want to build, as opposed to building up a picture of what the past looked like.
Liz, if you take the question, were women there, that Claire applied to her book, can that be applied to any historical concept, event retrospectively?
So I guess it's a, I guess it goes back to Blaney's quote, doesn't it? And your cheeky misuse of it. Because he would say that it's individualists who, that it's individuals and their, you know, their selective interests that define the history that they do. But in fact, history is written by the victors, right? We know that. And so, therefore, it is the historical canon isn't just authored by men, but it's authored by white men, and particularly the victors of colonialism. And so there's another kind of layer to, you know, whether women were there or not, I think, and that is which women were there. Eureka was a frontier too. So, and I mean, as you say, as you, you know, you note in your book, you know, Aboriginal women, you know, had this kind of fringe, you know, relationship to this establishing urban entity. What I did with my book was something a little bit different in terms of building a case, because I'm an activist before I'm an academic, and all of my research is in service to, I mean, in a similar way. I mean, you have a political intention to break apart these foundational national myths of manhood. And so I had a political intention to make the case that we are an especially nastily racist nation. I wanted to make that unapologetically clear. And that's because, I mean, the genesis for my book was different. It was a bit similar in that I also was researching my PhD. Claire and I are close colleagues. She's up the corridor. So we've done this at the same time and had kids at the same time and tried to marry all of this, you know, intense research and writing with, you know, with having kids, and that's hard work, I've got to say. That, as a feminist, just want to make a note of that. you know, the political intention for me was writing a book about flappers, right? I was writing about the camera and the way it changed the way women perceived themselves and were seen forever. Proximity, competition, beauty. So it was about visual identity and how visibility became an increasingly larger part of the wedge of identity for women. And while I was doing this research, mostly into 1920s newspapers and magazines, I found these incredible cartoons. And they were blood-curdlingly, eye-wateringly, hair-raisingly racist, these cartoons. I couldn't believe my eyes. And the striking thing was to me that this isn't part of our cultural knowledge and memory. And at first I just kind of went, oh, Jesus Christ. Some things are best left to history. And is it my place anyway as a white woman to recirculate this imagery? What if I'm just going to be calling up very hurtful memories for Aboriginal women, etc., etc.? But at the same time, I was very involved in the WIC activism and did a campaign called Stick With WIC, and we did the house plaques and the ribbons and the armbands, for better or worse. And, you know, there was this kind of growing call from Andrew Bolt and Geoffrey Blaney, Black Armband History and the way the term was adopted. And I just thought, well, in fact, we do. I mean, I actually made these armbands and sold them to the body shop. We do have to adopt a Black armband history. We're not going to have any chance of reconciliation if we don't know what that history is. Now, increasingly, there was this history of the massacres and the poisonings, but there was no, at that point, history of how the attitudinal base had to be in place for those things to happen. And given that print is, before radio, our principal medium for building shared understandings and consensus. I thought it was these cartoons, therefore, were very, very important. And I found a whole lot more. And then I started piecing together, well, what are the tropes for Aboriginal women around domesticity, maternity, sexuality? I quantified which were the dominant ones, and I put a tracery on each of them from Dampier right through to 1967. And what it revealed was blood-curdling. And so I did have a really strong political intention to build a case, but that's because, like you, when you had that aha moment with the licensing, it was like it was just a jump-out thing. This is really a gap in history. This really could confront some of the narratives that are being constructed at the moment by the victors, to serve their political purposes, and I want to disrupt that as an activist and with these skills as a researcher.
Yeah. And in fact, in your book, you talk about a sort of cultural amnesia that when it comes particularly to the cruel treatment of Indigenous women.
Yeah.
How important do you think it is to sharpen our memory of, you know, women's place in history? Are there risks involved in doing that, do you think?
I guess women's place in history is marginal, and it's often incredibly cruel. And in the very first attempts by feminist history to find the notable women, they were often the marquise of blah, 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 or, you know, very well established, you know, or advantaged women who were able to be painters or writers. So we feminists went and found those women, but they weren't actually speaking to the experience of most women, and certainly not women who are really complete. Like they're virtually, you know, women who get a moment in the archives because they were part of a group that were rushed by men with guns and killed. We're never going to know their names. We don't know where their bones are. Like, this kind of absenting is so extreme. You're looking at it and thinking, what would happen if we could put the names to these women and find them? And the best we can do is really go to their descendants and say, well, what stories do you have? And la la la. But I think Claire's book's really evocative in that sense too, because you're talking about women who are really... This is real struggle town. And the way you evocatively write about, you know, so you can smell the dust, you can imagine them trying to, you know, manage and parent, you know, I'm not going to say parent, I hate that fucking word, mother the children with, because it's not true, right? this is a lie. With, you know, all their silhouettes being reflected on the tent. I mean, it's so evocative, but it's that thing about... It's not just notable women that feminists have to find. We actually have to speak to the mass of women who were impoverished and doing it so hard in ways we can barely imagine, right?
And I think for me as well, it's been about... I've been interested in finding the women who are going looking for the women and then fortunately finding them, who have been in places that have, as I said, been traditionally gendered male. Mm. So part of my... my feminist agenda, has been to build a case, in a sense, for the way that men and women have always shared space as well. Because I think that we've been, that feminist history in particular, from, you know, 1975, or, you know, really the, you know, damn whores, and it's been very dichotomous, and it's been very shaped by the public-private sphere notion. And so the idea that if we're going to do women's history, we're going to go looking for women, and we're going to go looking for women in the places where women are. But we still have assumptions about that. We're still holding assumptions about the places that women are. That they're not in the pubs and they're not on the goldfields. And so I think one of the things about looking for them in places that are shared spaces, you know, to me it's a little bit like Inga Clendinning's idea of dancing with strangers as well, looking for the ways in which there have been collaborations as well as conflict. And that's not shying away from conflict. I think that's incredibly important to document conflict and to document dissent and to document the various ways in which people have performed acts of resistance. But I also think that you can go back to places that have been seen in a more rosy light and disrupt the narrative it's not just adding, and I think this is a really important thing, that adding women to it doesn't just add colour to that narrative. It's like, oh, here's the gold fields that we knew, that we've been taught about in school. It's like an American-style Wild West, and, you know, there's saloons and there's tumbleweeds blowing through town and you know, guns being shot. Here's the Wild West, and lo and behold, there's some women there as well. And isn't that a pretty scene? Actually, you know, or thinking or assuming, because we've got this Hollywood Wild West, that if there are women there, well, of course, they're whores, you know? They're either whores or they're the Deadwood, if you know, which is supposed to be revisionist television. They're still basically the whores and then the middle-class white woman peeking out from behind the curtain who's otherwise stoned to her eyeballs on whatever it is that she's sniffing. What is it? Laudanum. That, you know, she has to sniff laudanum to get through her days. So I think that what I did by building it from the ground up, you know, what the truly radical act is looking at the archive. It's time-consuming stuff, but, you know, as we well know, this is the enjoyable part of being an academic. You know, the rest of it's bullshit. But, you know, being able to spend time in the archive is where it's all at. And then that's what's allowed the opportunity to say, well, actually, you know what? What was going on in Ballarat? And, you know, and I think this is the very important thing, is when you sweep away all the assumptions, you've asked the questions that take you back into the archive, then you shut the fuck up and listen. You know, you just listen to what the archive is telling you. And the archive is very loud. You know, the voices coming out of the archive are very loud. And there are women's voices, but there are men's voices as well, and they're telling you things that you didn't know too. So you can't be too strident about where you're going to go looking for your evidence. And it was about finding women in these places and seeing that actually, when listening to the archive, what they were doing, they weren't just whoring and getting stoned. They were digging for gold. You know, they were baking cherry pies and selling them. They were putting on theatre productions. They were having babies in tents. They were demanding the right to have a tent set aside next to the main theatre that was for breastfeeding, so that when people went to the theatre, they didn't get left behind holding the baby. They took the baby with them and took it across the side. Like, you know, mind-blowing kind of stuff. Like when you say the blood-curdling stuff that you found, I found mind-blowing stuff. Like, you know, just looking down the lists of the things that were being sold in the chemists on the goldfields. And remember the time I'm talking about. It's all tents still, 1854. It's a tent city, 30,000 people living in tents. But there are apothecary tents, and they advertise in the Ballarat Times in the newspaper. You read down, you're running down, you know, there's toothing powders, and there's basically it's all cocaine and alcohol. And but you're running your finger down the list, and you go, breast pumps. They're selling breast pumps and nipple shields. And so when you see that, then, you know, there's a whole lot of other questions that then go off. If they're selling breast pumps, well, then there's women who are lactating. But it's not just women who are lactating. It's women who are having problems lactating in some way. They're trying to relieve mastitis. So that means their babies have died or their babies are failing to thrive. And, you know, so there's a whole lot of detail that then...
So how do you choose what detail to include and what not to include?
Oh, well, the first draft of my manuscript was 200,000 words, so I didn't choose. I wasn't very good at choosing. And even the end of it is quite a fat book. But it's like, you want people to know this stuff.
Yeah.
But I just want to go back to the question you ask, are there risks involved in it? Because I think that's a really interesting idea. And one of the things that I... one of the things that I did with my first book, Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, partly because it was a PhD thesis, but partly because I felt a great defensive sense that I was going to get slaughtered for saying this, that saying that not only was the pub not a male, was not a male domain, but actually women dominated this industry. It was a girls' club. I use that expression. Hotel keeping was a girls' club. Now, that's a very disruptive notion in terms of a broad cultural thing. So I did build a case very carefully. But what that does is makes, if we're talking actually about the writing of narrative non-fiction, what that does is make for very defensive writing. Mm-hmm. It is, and academic writing is very defensive writing. It's writing that assumes that people are going to be critiquing you from all angles at all times. And what
sounds like talkback radio.
Yeah. And so it's an argument-driven book.
Yeah.
And when I went to publish it, I actually had a number of publishers who said, you know, the more popular mainstream publishers who said, we'd like to publish this, but we'd like you to turn it into a narrative base, and we'd like more colourful characters to come out. And I wanted hard argument, you know. I wanted legal cases that showed what was going on, and I decided that it was necessary to have that. Mm. And the people could come along after me and write in the colourful characters, but this had to be the pointy end of the disruptive element. When I came to writing Eureka, because it didn't have to be a PhD, I didn't have to have it, it wasn't examined, it was my postdoctoral research, but I was free. I still wanted it to be narrative non-fiction. I wasn't going to make anything up, but I wanted to let my writing lift off the page, and I wanted there to be much more lightness and colour and joy in the writing, mostly because the goldfields were an amazing time. The gold rush was incredible. It was so baroque, and I wanted my language to, it's kind of, you know, people say it's a very, in some ways, disturbing book to read because it's so fun, it's such a romp, and yet at the end of it, you think, well, if I didn't know the whole truth about that story, how many other stories have we been told that we also aren't being told the whole truth of the matter? That also women were there. So that is a kind of disconcerting. But back to the risk factor, the thing that I found really has been incredibly affirming for me is that I didn't get slaughtered. This was another sacred cow that I'd knocked on the head, but all the reviews were incredibly positive. Sales went through the roof. I get as many emails and letters from men who have read it as women. And I wasn't setting out to write a book that was going to please everybody. I was setting out to write a book that would please myself. But it did make me feel that Australia was at a particular moment where it could accept that. It made me feel I'm a totally Pollyanna person, so I might be right off the ball here. But it did make me feel like it was not risky business being a feminist historian.
Mm. But is there that risk when you put women in the centre of a story that is perhaps even at this, that you may be viewed as a historical revisionist, perhaps?
Oh, well, I can't put women in the centre of the story because I don't... What happens in the colonial archive is such a profound absenting that at least to do... So it's a kind of... it's interesting because we're kind of... they're very different projects, and this one doesn't have the colour and the romp, the romp of truth. I like that. Because it's a pretty miserable story, and it's not nationally redemptive. It's not like we can feel better about this national moment once we understand women are here, were there, and these women were incredible, you know. And it's not nationally redemptive. This book, in fact, I think writing it was, pretty dissembling, and I think reading it isn't going to be easy. I think it might be a bit like being hit over the head repeatedly by a mallet, because the bubble that I'm bursting is one of colonial triumphalism and colonial chivalry and colonial gallantry. And what I'm not telling a story either. I'm tracing motifs, and what I had to do with the fact that the women were so grotesquely absented, to the point where in the first chapter I show, I tell the story of Aramaida, who was a Tasmanian woman, an amazing story. And this is just exactly, once you have names and the women are there, you can actually start to find this incredible story. So, you know, the Baudin expedition of 1801, Francois Perron, this zoologist who was very, you know, instilled in the notion of the noble savage, you know, he comes to Tasmania and he starts, you know, getting into these kind of problems with the people there. They're offending each other. There's all these misunderstandings. And at one point he comes onto a beach. There's a group of women. And Ara Maeda gets up and pretty much says, sit down. She starts dancing around him in this way that's very provocative. And then she takes charcoal and crushes it between her hands and covers his face in it. Right. So incredible, you know, when you think about it. How on earth are we going to make sense of that?
How can we possibly... How is that documented, Liz?
Sheena Kanishi wrote it and Francois Perron wrote about it. So
right.
It's his story.
Yeah.
How can we, you know, how can we get our heads around that and understand that? So I tell the story of Ara Maeda's image, which is first made by Lesueur, and then it turns into an engraving, and I'm a print historian, so this the work I do, and I show how it, over generations, went all around the world. Her image was reproduced in Germany, in Italy, in America, all over the place, and her name got dropped. I talk about name dropping. Her name got dropped. She got obscene. She got typed. And so I'm sort of telling a story about the archival absenting of women. Mm. And so because I can't tell their stories, I tell a different narrative. And that is, it's a cultural history of settler racism as it was, you know, applied, or as Aboriginal women were subjected to it. And so, I mean, there are, perhaps when we go into question time, there are big questions here about whether that's my place to do that too. And, you know, what can my relationship back to communities be in that process? Mm. You know, this is a big ethical issue that I hope the book is presents an occasion to have quite difficult discussions, actually. Anyway, so it's a very different process. It's about managing a complete and ineluctable absenting.
Although these women had been absented from the way that history had been written for 150 years as well, and that is a kind of sub-story that, because I chose to write it as a narrative, with, you know, a bookendy kind of little bit where I break out and talk as the historian in a way to give it context, but you know, this is an example of settler sexism. Mm. These women were there. Everybody knew they were there. Mm. The people at the time who didn't know they were going to be part of a famous historical event, obviously. I mean, that's what primary sources do. Mm. You know, we're writing emails to each other or putting on a festival, not knowing that in 150 years' time, what happens is happening today might be really incredibly important, because something really massive might happen tomorrow that we don't know. You know, these people don't know that they're making history. They're just observing the world around them, as opposed to the historians who then all have an agenda in the terms of the way that they're going to put that narrative together, a la the Blaney quote. Mm. You know, everybody has their reasons for writing the story the way that they do. So the sub-question for me always was then, where did this story go? Why did the women disappear from history?
Yeah. Mm.
And the women knew, this was the fascinating thing, the women knew it was happening themselves. Because basically part of that answer is that after the Eureka Stockade and all those people died, it was really awful and everybody felt bad about it. Mm. And there were people who celebrate or commemorated it on the first anniversary. There were people around the grave sites. And by the second anniversary, there was a little handful of people, and then nobody talked about Eureka for another 30 years.
Mm.
It was just basically wiped from... People got on with the business of being racist settlers, you know? building racist towns, building racist industries, and, you know... having massive families. I mean, a lot of these women, I should say, they were very young. The average age at Eureka was about 22, 23.
Wow.
And 80% of the Victorian population at the time was under the age of 40.
Mm.
And so most of these women were having their first baby at Eureka and went on to have 10 or 12 more. So there's not a whole, you know, lot of time for talking about what was going on in the past. Everybody was pretty much on this now. But 30 years later, in 1884, there starts to be a bit of movement around the idea. And Ballarat's now an incredibly big, settled city. The 1880s, the property boom, Melbourne Exhibition's about to come up this whole time. Mm. 1884, they start talking about commemorating it, and they start looking back, and people start writing to the newspapers telling their stories about the way things happened, and they start holding committees to have Eureka commemorations and start talking about building monuments and memorials. And everything is just talking about, you know, the great men, the heroes of Eureka, mm-hmm. the heroes whose Henry Lawson said this, whose blood stained the wattle. And, you know, this was the way that all of these people started to, the whole bulletin school, they all started to talk about it. And women started writing into the newspaper saying, hang on, I was there too. This happened to me. And they start writing their stories. One woman talks about having her hair bullet fired at her and half her head blown off, and she had a baby in her arms at a time. Another woman writes a poem, and she signs it A Lady of 54, and they use very inclusive language to claim this story as ours. Mm. But there's no women who are invited to be at any of the events. And by 1904, and a lot of that generation has died, it's become a completely, by the 50th anniversary, it's become an all-male story. And by the 1954, by the 100th anniversary, it's all gone. Any trace of them is gone. So it's an in absentia thing as well.
Yeah.
There are forces at work that are talking about the kind of national stories that are the ones that we want to be telling around the time of Federation. Mm. What sort of nation do we want to be? Well, it was a masculine one. It was a white one. I mean, the other thing that gets white from the Eureka story is the incredible ethnic diversity that is present. There were members of every nation in the world, including Indigenous people. The Watarang were very important presence on the goldfields. Mm. And their stories are starting to be reclaimed and retold now as well. Mm. The way that they were not just victims of the gold rush, but they actually made an incredible opportunity of the fact that there are all these people here who needed stuff, and including people telling them where the gold was, because the Watarang knew that there was gold in the ground. Mm. They didn't know it was valuable because it wasn't valuable to them, but it was once all these people were going mad for the shit and give them stuff in exchange for local knowledge. And so Fred Carr has written very extensively about this, but, you know, there were Jews at Eureka, there were Northern Europeans, there were Maori, there were, you know, everybody from the whole world came to this gold rush, and that story gets wiped as well, because it is not part of this Europe is Anglo, and then the battle part of it, the revisionist part of it, comes to talk about the Irish. So it becomes an English-Irish battle. And it becomes tied up with the kind of sectarianism that goes on around the First World War and after that. But that was part of what was going on there, but it wasn't the only part of it. There was a lot of other stuff as well. So I think that leading happens on many different levels.
Mm. Claire, in your book you also use another quote at the very beginning. It's from Professor Laurel Thatcher Ulrich from Harvard University, and it says, "Well-behaved women seldom make history." Mm. We look at a broader picture of history. Why does that happen, do you think?
Well, it's a much-quoted quote now. Well-behaved women seldom make history. What she was getting at is that you need to make some noise. You need to make a ruckus. You know it's an activist statement in itself.
Mm.
And so one of the things that has been important to me in this has been part of, you know, my feminist agenda, and particularly having a daughter and watching the way that her primary education still reinforces all these stereotypes about what girls do and what boys do, and what girls did in the past and what boys did in the past, and what roles you can play. Mm. And, you know, just for example, she got a project that came back from school. They were doing explorers, and you could do this. You could do your project as a multimedia display, or a claymation, you know, or upload it to YouTube. There were all these technologies that were in place to try to engage the students. And there's a list of 6 explorers, and you had to say what they had done and what great discoveries they had made. And you know where I'm going with this story. All 6 of those names were male. They were all white. It was a very narrow definition of what exploring meant. Mm. There was no sense that that is a very contested word in itself. Mm. And so part of what I really wanted to do, and it's also why I wrote a young adult version of the book, which is now being used in schools, is to give girls role models from history about what they might, particularly about the idea that you have to make history. Nothing just happens. Mm-hmm. And if you see that women were involved in events that were that changed things, well, maybe you feel like you can change things too, and that you can get in, you can get involved in it. And again, that sounds very Pollyanna, and you know, which women, and you know, all of those things. But on just a very kind of basic level, that idea that, you know, well-behaved women seldom make history. You know, just sort of being quiet and being nice and consenting to the dominant paradigms and keeping yourself nice is not necessarily what's going to get you noticed. And of course, girls today have, because of that amazing image that you just said, Liz, before about the wedge of women's
identity,
the visibility. Mm. I mean, if in the 20s, the 1920s, and the flap of the visibility went to that, like, I can't even make my arms.
No, you've got to
go like that to what visibility, physical.
Yeah.
Visibility is for girls
now. Yeah,
so that the dominant and idea that how you look is what's going to get attention.
Yeah.
Give you get attention, not what you do.
Yeah.
Mm. Is, I think, very. It's very subliminally enhanced, that idea, by how girls are taught history.
Yeah, and that's racialized. So
and
there's a whole absenting that goes on within that around, you know, who can take up public space, who's worthy to be in public space, and then they're the women that get remembered.
Yeah,
the notables, and there's a whole thing about like behaviour. There's a whole thing about class when you think about women and the kinds of forces that has, you know, really subjected them, like, you know, reproductive control. So women that were in better off families were more likely to get away with premarital affairs or extramarital affairs and pregnancies because there were networks and resources to deal with them than younger women, working class women, who were more likely to end up in, you know, institutions and training homes and have their children removed from them. So there's a whole class differential going on there as well. But in terms of visibility, there's a whole, you know, absenting going on within that now too, where, you know, we make a pretense around racial diversity or disability, and I mean, God knows, age and body shape, where it's so extraordinarily homogenised, the presence of women in public space, that women who are noted beauties, end up being spokespeople for the UN, like Audrey Hepburn, Angelina Jolie, Cate Blanchett. You know, isn't it lucky when they're great women? But it's a bit freaking hit and miss, isn't it? So, you know, there's a whole, I mean, actually Kate Millett talked about, you know, privilege, and, you know, I think she's one of the first to talk about the subsets of privilege in terms of public access around, you know, not just race, class, gender, but ethnicity, but, you know, sexuality, but, you know, age, disability and beauty. Mm. And that, in fact, beauty was a privileged, positionality that enabled you to access a whole bunch of things. So when we say, if you want to make history, you have to behave badly, it also doesn't help if you're 6'2" and blonde and 22 years old.
We might just leave it there. Open it up to some questions. Has anyone got any questions for you?
Just thinking about the they failed to mention the role of nurses. So sort of in the face of governments that are complicit in, you know, this male-centric history, are you optimistic for the way it's continuing to be taught in schools? And also, are there any titles that you can recommend that are writing back into history?
I think we're actually going back into a very... I mean, I think we're slipping back into, you know, the desperate attempt of the hard right to win the culture wars. And we're sort of seeing some slippage and some falling away with that. But they really have had a strong hold on things. You know, the National Curriculum Review, you know. So we've actually been under this glom for a long, long time, where we've had the hard right of the Liberal Party, you know, the think tanks, the IPA, informing these, you know, cultural institutions, the Fairfax Board, the ABC Board, and indeed, you know, the history curriculum, the national history curriculum. So it's really been, you know, we've been in the jaws of this for, you know, over a decade now, since Howard. And, I mean, I think we're still really struggling with that. And I think, you know, Claire's book, for instance, is the kind of thing that busts that apart. So it's really, really important. But whether Claire's book's going to end up on the national curriculum, as it should...
I think that that's a really interesting question, because it raises a really challenging point.
Yeah.
The thing about, the Anzac nurses. Okay, now... You know, I've just made this argument for why it's really important for girls to have role models in history, and important for us to know that women were there, and clearly women had been written out of the Anzac trope for a long time, the whole militarist narrative that is so central to Australian politics and identity. Now, women have increasingly been written into that as nurses, and I think what has happened is that I don't want to see them not happen. I don't want those nurses not to be written about. I think it's important that their experiences are also documented and held out. But I also think that the Anzac nurses have been co-opted into a militaristic narrative that underpins the conservative right that Liz is talking about. And we see that in other ways as well. So we also get the black Anzacs. You know, and the Jewish Anzacs, and you know, you could blow this to into farce, and you know, say, when are we going to get the vegan Anzacs? Or you know, but it is kind of like nothing against vegans, but it is, you know, it is that kind of this still does underpin the same narrative, and it's a bit like what I was getting at before about adding women to the story and it gives it colour, but it doesn't actually change the shape of the narrative. And
yet,
that's what was really important to me about Eureka, to say, well, if you put those women back in the story, and you know, you have to talk about the fact that domestic violence was incredibly prevalent on the goldfields, and these women were getting bashed to the shit house, and ask the question, you know, why? What were the conditions that were going on? But what that does is it disrupts part of that whole nationalistic idea of the goldfields and the pub, blah, 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 as being egalitarian spaces.
Yeah.
I don't think egalitarianism had anything to do with what was going on at Eureka. I think there were aspects of justice and fairness that were at play. Those were certainly principles, political principles that were being fought for, but I don't think that's egalitarianism. Nobody wanted to be the same as anybody else. Everybody just wanted to their chance of climb the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
So it did. It was the stirrings of a meritocracy, but it had nothing to do with quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where things get tricky. I don't want women not to be studied as nurses, and it's one of the reasons that when I made the documentary "The War That Changed Us" for the ABC. And I did actually have my opportunity to disrupt the Anzac narrative. I was entirely blown off my chair that the ABC went for this idea. I actually put it up because I didn't want them to say they didn't have an alternative, so they just made the same old thing. I gave them an alternative and they went for it. But part of that was to put a woman in the story, so they use an Anzac nurse, but there's also a woman who's a pacifist, Vida Goldstein, who had a lot to do with this building and this part of the world. Mm. Their headquarters of the Women's Peace Army was just in what's now RMIT at Story Hall there. Mm. And that, you know, those women mobilised 80,000 women to walk down Swanson Street over to Yarra Bank, you know, on the other side of Birrarung Mar, had 80,000 people there for an anti-conscription march. And, you know, it's really important that, you know, those women were fighting against the war. Mm. So it was about adding a bit of, you know, balance back into that story. So it's about which of those stories are going to be told as well. And
apologies, but wasn't we've only got it? Sorry. We've got time for one more question, one quick question, anyone? Okay.
Thank you for that. That was really interesting to hear, and I'm really excited to hear both of your projects. On the question that you sort of raised, Liz, concerning, I guess, you know, the centralist version of like how we kind of like do this better, I was wondering if either of you had actually encountered Larissa Behrendt's Finding Eliza, which is a book that came out earlier this year, sort of revisiting the history of Coogari, now called Fraser Island, through these two versions of Eliza Fraser's as kind of captive narrative, and the negotiations that she makes in this sort of historical revision by actually speaking to the Batchelor people and using oral testimony, but also reflecting on that through her own positionality. I'm wondering if that is perhaps a way in which we can be, you know, seeing some sort of more positive future for this sort of supposedly historical revisionism, which is really actually just going back into the history and trying to do it a bit better.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the opportunity there for Larissa to reflect on the legacies of that colonial history in her own Aboriginal identity it's really, really important. And really, I guess, ideally, colonial history should be written by the very opposite of the victors, and that's the people who are, you know, reclaiming a shared identity as being, you know, subjected to that and still living today with its impacts. And including the impacts of tropes around Aboriginal mothers being inherently incompetent, around, you know, pickaninnies as being inherently better raised by whites, you know, those things we are still seeing them played out in Dondale and so on. So, I mean, yeah, definitely. And, I mean, the Eliza story is such a telling one precisely because of the way Eliza and the men who's around her saw, you know, a commodity opportunity in Eliza's story to construct a narrative of the white captive woman and her sexual and otherwise subjection by the savage, and she was a part of that. This was capital for her, in a way that just wasn't for William Buckley. You know, I mean, he just spoke in monosyllables and just didn't want to have any part of it. But Eliza was, you know, I mean, she was both exploited, but she was also, you know, contributing to that for her own ends. So it's an interesting story about print as well, you know, and exactly what we were talking about, which women can appear in it. And so, I mean, I think it's wonderful that Larissa's reflecting on those things.
Can I make two really quick points? Really quick. Interestingly, I just recommended that book to one of my postgrad students, and he's a young man, and the reason I want to say this is because I think that feminist history isn't just for women, and it's not just about projects that involve women. Mm. He's doing a project about, his thesis is on Indigenous people in Tasmania, and he's got a really strong idea that there's a right answer and a wrong answer, like that there's a very clear idea of the truth. And we've been trying to push him towards the idea of interpreting documents, and that everybody who writes a document writes it from a perspective. And I've recommended Larissa's book for him to read to try to get that sense of understanding how things are constructed and things are layered and nuanced. And even though his project is not to do with women or anything. So I think her book is really important. And the second quick point is that I'm doing a session at the Melbourne Writers Festival on Sunday the 4th of September. I'm the chair and I'm talking to Henry Reynolds and Bruce Pascoe about historical revisionism. Mm. So if people want to take up this whole idea of revisionism but in a slightly different context, please come along to that.
Please thank Liz and Claire.
This has been a special broadcast from Broad at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival on Joy 94.9.
Thank you, sisters. You've been listening to this Broad podcast here on Joy 94.9. Don't forget to tune into us Monday nights at 9 p.m. on Joy for feminism in your ears.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.